American Enterprise, Philanthropic Business, Centrist Perspective. You're listening to The American Element. My guest today is Russ George, the world's most notorious geoengineer. For almost 30 years, Russ has been a self-described one-trick pony. He's worked on ocean pasture restoration, usually referred to as iron fertilization in the press. It is technology that uses iron sifted in small quantities over a large area to create a plankton bloom, which can restore fish stocks and sequester carbon when the organic material eventually sinks to the ocean floor. In 2012, Russ gained notoriety for introducing over 100 tons of iron into the ocean off the Haida Gwaii Islands in collaboration with local native peoples and the Canadian government. The experiment set off a media and legal firestorm. Controversy only swelled when the salmon catch quadrupled in 2013 and the scientific community admitted that the experiment had worked. I was interested in Russ not primarily as an environmentalist, but because he seems to have harnessed a disruptive technology and inspired politicized scandal. Whatever you may believe about the risks and potential of iron fertilization, or OPR, it was clear to me that Russ's story has not really been told. It is also clear that in a world spending billions on carbon offsets, even as we give up on actually halting climate change, we can't afford not to consider every option. Thank you so much for joining me today, Russ. Can you tell me about your work?
Okay. It's a big job. I've been at this since 1989, when I learned of the pioneering work of a guy named John Martin in California, who's the sort of grandfather of this topic. And I was living quite close to him at the time, and a friend sent me faxed me a political cartoon out of the Boston Globe where John Martin had been, and his work with ocean plankton had been mentioned. And
what was the cartoon?
He was standing and he was presenting a paper at a big ocean science conference, and he spoke to the crowd saying that the problem that, and this was 1989, and he said the problem facing the world was global warming. And global warming was caused by carbon dioxide. But that as an ocean scientist, he knew carbon dioxide was managed by the ocean plankton, the plant plankton in the ocean. And in turn, he'd spent his life studying how dust that carries minerals to the ocean is what controls the plankton. So he said the mineral in the dust that's most important to plankton is iron. Mm-hmm. And he'd done exhaustive scientific research on how much iron was needed. And he said, well, the problem is there's too much CO2 in the world's atmosphere, but if you give me a shipload of iron, I'll give you another ice age.
That might be the most dramatic claim ever made in the geoengineering movement, that one shipload of iron could do more to change our climate than everything humans have done so far on the planet is either exciting or frightening. Can you tell us more about that theory?
Yeah, he'd done the research, and his specialty, he was an ocean chemist. Mm-hmm. So he'd done the physical chemical studies of the ocean. But he'd seen that iron was controlling phytoplankton growth in the ocean, plankton blooms. And he looked into the geologic record, the ocean sediment records, for a million or more years, and looked at all the different ice ages that had occurred in those several million years, and had noticed in the sediment record that just prior to every ice age, there was a record in the sediment of a massive amount of plankton blooming in the ocean.
Wow, that's not the story that I was brought up with as a child. I have an image in my head of a dinosaur getting hit with an asteroid or a volcano blotting out the sun. And you're inserting that plankton are a major character in that story, or maybe the major player in how the planet regulates temperature. Describe the way in which you believe they work to do that.
So global warming is believed to be caused by too much carbon dioxide accumulating in the atmosphere, and that carbon dioxide comes from the burning of fossil fuels. Yeah. And so today there is about a trillion tons of extra carbon dioxide that has accumulated in the world's atmosphere over the past 100 years, which is about a rate of about 10 billion tons per year, right? Yeah. you know, over 100 years times 10, that's a trillion. Mm-hmm. And so plants, whether they're a tree growing on land or a plant or a microscopic tree that floats in the ocean, ocean plankton, they take carbon dioxide out of the air and use sunlight, photosynthesis, to extract the carbon from the carbon dioxide to make more plant material.
So then once the plants have extracted that carbon, they then presumably sink to the bottom of the ocean and are sequestered? Is that how it works?
Well, it's like if they're a forest, right? The I call it a pasture. The ocean is full of plant pasture that are full of ocean phytoplankton. And just like a forest stores carbon dioxide in the living forest, ocean stores carbon dioxide in the living plant life in the ocean that keeps getting recycled and stored there. And the more plant life, you know, the bigger the trees, the more trees you have, the more carbon is stored on land. Some of the carbon in a tree is stored in its root system in underground, and some of it sort of from the material that falls to the ground is incorporated in the soil. Mm-hmm. And in the very same way, that's how carbon dioxide is stored in the ocean as plant life.
Okay, so is the premise behind John Martin's technology that iron is such a limiting nutrient that by increasing the availability of iron, you can radically increase the amount of bioactivity going on in the oceans?
Yeah, because the idea is that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas blanket, mm-hmm, that covers the Earth and it keeps when the sun lands on the planet and warms the planet, the warmth would radiate out into space, yep, save for the thickness of the carbon dioxide blanket, mm-hmm, that we have. So more carbon dioxide means a thicker blanket, means a warmer planet. Yep. Less carbon dioxide means no blanket, means a cold planet.
So it seems like in the last 10 years, there's been a growing consensus and concern about global warming. And now we're starting to recognize, it seems like, that the situation is pretty dire. Is that accurate in your opinion?
Yeah, it's more than 10 years. So 100 years ago, the Swedish chemist Arrhenius, mm-hmm, described how carbon dioxide was accumulating in the world's atmosphere and creating the greenhouse effect. And 20 years ago, the Kyoto Accord was signed that created the sort of modern day activity that's been focused on climate change, mm-hmm, due to fossil fuel, yeah, gases. And so today, you know, we're in this crisis mode where people are trying to figure out, you know, what are we going to do?
Sure.
Right. And so that last year in Paris, the world's nations, 197 nations, agreed to the Paris Accord. Mm-hmm. And the Paris Accord says those 197 nations agree to do something to reduce the amount of global warming, amount of greenhouse gases that are going into the atmosphere, yeah, and that are warming the planet. And they're expecting to spend $3.5 trillion a year in new climate taxes to do that. So
taxing and limiting carbon has become such a big business, but geoengineering hasn't received very much attention, very much investment. Well, you know, talk to me a little bit about your work and the potential and future for geoengineering.
Well, I'm just sort of following in the scientific, as part of the scientific community. So back in 1989, when John Martin made his monumental speech about this, it started the world's ocean science community on a trail of studying whether we could restore the dust. The problem with CO2 is in the ocean is that CO2 on land, when CO2 has an impact on plant life everywhere, mm-hmm, and the plants on land in the current high CO2 environment are growing better. Mm. And mostly this planet is a planet covered with grass, not with trees.
Yeah.
And so when there's more grass or concrete, and we know that when you have lots of grass, we call that good ground cover. And so the more grass that's growing on the planet is covering the ground. So more grass growing means less dust is blowing in the wind. Mm-hmm. Sure. And it's the dust that blows in the wind that feeds ocean plant life. Mm. And so the loss of dust blowing in the wind, which is what John Martin studied, amounts to a shipload of rock dust, right? Call that 100,000 tons, right? That's one shipload of iron ore. Well, Australia last year sold 700 million tons of iron ore to China alone to make the steel that our cars and our rebar and everything is made out of.
And the next step in the industrial revolution that brought us all this carbon.
That's right. And that's thousands of shiploads, right? And if one out of the many thousands of shiploads of iron ore were diverted and sprinkled in the ocean, according to John Martin's math, that would be enough to restore the ocean back to historic health and abundance, and it would scrub all of humanity's CO2 out of the air and convert it into ocean life. Yeah. What could be better?
That's in many ways a seductive idea, although it's an idea that the environmentalist in me has trouble accepting. We relate to the oceans as places that should be preserved. The ideal is clear blue water, and humans have always fought to keep things out of that water. You might say it's in our DNA. We want to keep water untouched by the hands of man. What would you say to someone who didn't believe it was responsible to rev the ocean's bioengine to make up for the carbon we produce on land?
Well, it's not even revving. It's the ocean has declined, has collapsed, right? So our CO2 has forced the ocean plant life into an incredible decline, so that there's only about 50% as much plant life growing in the ocean today as there was 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And to put that in the context, everybody's concerned about rainforests, and we've all heard about the problem with the Amazon rainforest being harvested and cut down, and lots of people say, don't cut down the Amazon rainforest. Well, we've lost 20% of the Amazon rainforest, and there's a global cry of alarm over the remaining 80% of the Amazon rainforest. But in every 5-year span of time since 1950, there's an amount of ocean plant life that has been eradicated from the oceans that's equal to an entire Amazon rainforest. So the problem on the planet is oceans are suffering. And what John Martin said, he said the miracle of plant life in the ocean is that it's incredibly powerful and productive and efficient if it only has a little bit of dust to feed on.
That's interesting.
So one shipload of dust could manage all of humanity's CO2. And so I followed in his footsteps, and a dozen experiments were conducted at the cost of $250 million over the past 30 years to take dust out to the ocean and conduct experiments and see whether or not it really would restore the ocean plant life to normal, to natural health and abundance. And so in 2012, after multiple tries, I managed to do the one project that the international science community had called for. That was a 100 by 100 kilometer square patch of ocean that was dusted with rock dust, iron dust.
Yep.
And so in the summer of 2012, me and I was working with an Indian village on the remote north coast of British Columbia, right on the border with Alaska. Mm-hmm. And we went out to sea several hundred miles out from their islands of Haida Gwaii, which is in the Gulf of Alaska. And we took 100 tons of our rock dust, and we traveled back and forth.
On fire,
We turned, and the ocean turned from a clear blue desert that it was into a lush green ocean pasture.
The first major iron fertilization experiment occurred in July 2012. In October, the British newspaper The Guardian published an article calling the experiment illegal and questioning your for-profit motivation. Tell me about being on the receiving end of that instant notoriety.
Well, I've been working my whole life, right? So I'm 60 something now, and back in when I was a 20 something, a young 20 year old something, you know, and instead of going to Vietnam, I moved to Canada. That was my choice at the time. And so that's right. And I started a tree planting business here in British Columbia. And so I always thought this, that, you know, what could be better than to plant a tree or to restore a damaged ecosystem? You know, that's got to be the holiest of holy thing of holies that you can do. And
human beings think very differently about fostering plant growth on land versus in our oceans. Yet what you were doing was unique. It's a little like dumping a powerful fertilizer from an airplane on an internationally owned forest. As an ocean scientist with a background in tree farming, you had the background to think in a certain way about the practice, and the negative press coverage must have taken you by surprise.
Yeah, and people tackled my work with outrageous comments. I mean, you know, we literally worked for myself. I worked with the Indian village for 6 years. Mm-hmm. In preparation for the work. And during that six-year period, the village had to file quarterly reports every year. So every 90 days, they had to file a report and get permission to continue on the project from the Government of Canada, mm-hmm. which governs all Indian villages, right? Because they receive federal funding. And we had the National Research Council of Canada worked with us. And when I had to hire scientists for the project, the National Research Council of Canada was going to contribute 50% of their salary, but only if they got to approve the resumes of the people that I proposed to hire. So we had, and we had the...
Yeah, a significant amount of engagement is sort of the bottom line.
Oh, yeah, we had guarantees. You know, we worked for 6 years with 8 different government ministries, and so we had absolute, complete, top-to-bottom review. We had the top ocean scientists in Canada working with us, consulting with us. And
there's little recognition in the media coverage of the 2012 experiment that you had anything approaching scientific support. How did that narrative differ from what occurred?
Well, yeah. What happened is, you know, people like the most famous environmental person in Canada is a guy named David Suzuki. And David Suzuki went once we got back from being out on the ocean, you know, working and bringing life back to the ocean, mm-hmm. the British Guardian fabricated a story that was nothing but a pack of lies about how bad our work was. I was a rich American oligarch who'd come up to do this rogue project.
Ross is a rich oligarch.
I'm not. I'm the far opposite end of the spectrum, and. But they claimed it was a rogue project. There was no science. David Suzuki, you know, Canada's most treasured environmental scientist, commentator, said it wasn't science, it was a stunt. And I kind of said, wait a second, David, the National Research Council of Canada doesn't fund stunts, they fund science. Tim Parsons, who's in Canada, if you want to win what's the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for ocean science, you hope that you might win a medal in Canada called the Tim Parsons Medal. Mm-hmm. Well, Tim Parsons was one of our primary collaborators on the work before, during, and after the work. You know, so, you know, how could we be doing a stunt instead of science? So the problem was, is it worked?
In 2013, the year following the Haida Gwaii experiment, 283 million fish were caught off the coast of Alaska alone, the largest salmon catch in history by far, about 150 million more fish than have normally been caught in the region. In trying to identify the downside to what you did, it was hard to identify specific concerns apart from a general sense that it was too risky.
Well, it scared people, and the people it scared were the people in the climate change world, mm-hmm. because the business that we set up with the Haida people that I set up was called the Haida Salmon Restoration Company, mm-hmm. and the intent of the business was to see if we could bring their fish back to historic abundance, yeah. and we hoped that we'd be able to measure the amount of carbon dioxide that was sucked out of the air as well. Mm-hmm. But the primary goal was to bring the fish back. Yeah. And so the following summer, when the first opportunity to see, you know, the problem with salmon is people think salmon are being overfished, mm-hmm. or they think their habitat on land is being demolished. And that's happening to some extent, although we've done massive restoration on land, and the fishing has collapsed. The commercial fishery has collapsed. That's why the Haida wanted to do the project, because years ago they used to all be able to catch all the fish they wanted. And now they can't. Often they don't catch enough fish, mm-hmm. to feed the people over the winter. And so what we did was bring the fish back. And so the best measure of that is in Alaska, the pink salmon, which is the first species that we influenced, mm-hmm. were out in our pasture. The one-year-old pink salmon were in our ocean pasture when we made it bloom. Yep. And they only had one more year of have life at sea before they would swim home to the Gulf of to the rivers and streams in the Gulf of Alaska. And so the very next year, 2013, the expected catch of pink salmon in Alaska was going to be a really good catch. 50 million fish were expected. Mm-hmm. Instead, 226 million were caught.
So there's been some recognition of the relationship between your experiment and the increase in fish catch, but the climate change community has never shifted in its opposition. What do you think the climate change movement is focused on, and why?
Well, it all you just have to follow the money, because the world of climate change is all about money. Mm-hmm. And so,
well, hopefully not, but
yeah, not, well, it's about saving the planet. But yeah. So many people are involved in the money equation, right? When there's a $3.4 trillion trough being created, there's a crowd trying to nuzzle up and get their nose into the trough and get their share. And what we did is, our little project, so me and 11 Indians got on one single fish boat here in British Columbia, and we loaded up 4,050 pound bags of rock dust, of iron mineral, right? And I, you know, bent my back, hefting those bags. Mm-hmm. And we took it out to sea, and we sprinkled it over a 10,000 square kilometer patch of ocean. And it was, if you imagine that you were walking down the street and you had a salt shaker in your hand, and you were gently shaking the salt shaker, you know, as you walked along, and you went 100 kilometers, 50 miles one way, turned around, came back 50 miles, turned around, went a mile, went back 50 miles, and you covered those 10,000 square kilometers at a walking pace, shaking a salt shaker. That's how much dust we put in the ocean. So an infinitesimal amount, right?
You did cover a lot of ground.
Yeah. Oh, it took a long, long weeks to cover the ground, right, on the boat. Mm-hmm. Well, the plankton grew, and it sucked CO2 out of the air, and we had all manner of scientific instruments that we were measuring. So we stayed there. We measured before. We measured while we were dusting, after we were dusting. We had satellites looking. We had robots swimming the ocean. We had things. So one of the things we saw is that when the plankton started blooming, we'd take the boat 50 kilometers outside of the bloom and then run back across the bloom so that we'd cover an area of 200 kilometers, 50 kilometers on each side plus 100.
You could see that it was...
Well, we could see in the CO2 measurement in the air that outside of the bloom area, the natural CO2 concentration of the atmosphere was high. Mm-hmm. But as soon as we entered the bloom, the CO2 level would plummet. So the ocean had become a sponge for CO2 in the atmosphere.
And presumably the concept being that some of that, you know, not all of that carbon, some of it's going to be released back into the air as the organic matter decomposes, but some of it is going to end up on the bottom of the ocean, and it's going to be removed from the atmosphere, and you're going to be lessening that blanket.
Yeah. And so we now know that that little project sucked tens of millions of tons of CO2 out of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Well, by comparison, on the day that we got back to Vancouver on the ship, when we'd finished the project, there was a media in the Canadian press was touting a story where the federal government of Canada, the government of the province of Alberta, and Shell Oil from Canada had each invested one-third of $1.2 billion, so they'd each put in $400 million to build a CO2 scrubber attached to a smokestack of a coal-fired power plant in Alberta. Sure. And they were spending $1.2 billion to build a machine that would each year scrub 1 million tons of CO2 out of the atmosphere. Mm. Well, me and 11 Indians spread $70,000 of rock dust on the ocean, on their ocean. It's the natives' people's ocean pasture. Mm-hmm. So we did that over the course of a month. Yeah. And our $72,000 investment scrubbed tens of millions of tons of CO2 out of the atmosphere. And it sent the pink salmon catch, the extra pink salmon that were caught in Alaska the following year, has now been reported on by the state of Alaska. It represented $724 million of economic stimulus in the state of Alaska. And I had a friend who's a fisherman who lives in Ketchikan, Alaska. And I phoned him up and I said, Bill, can you tell me you know, can you help me get a hold of some fishermen because I want to hear some stories about what happened when they caught all the fish? And he says, well, I can tell you one story. He says, every fisherman in the town of Ketchikan is driving a brand new $40,000 pickup truck right now, right? So that was the economic stimulus of, you know, of a handful of guys.
Assuming that iron fertilization is as effective as you believe it to be, or even 50% as effective at sequestering carbon, it would have the characteristics of a disruptive technology. I spoke to one environmentalist friend who opposed considering iron fertilization because he didn't want to let carbon-producing industries off the hook. But we don't live in a zero-sum world. Global warming will harm the poorest billion people on the planet most of all. If the technology works, it seems that we should measure it against its risks, but that's not a conversation we seem to be having.
Well, it just works, right? And what it does is it delivers fish. Mm-hmm. It brings the fish back to historic abundance. So, you know, the hundreds of millions of extra salmon that were caught in Alaska, mm-hmm. that were put into freezers and into cans, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has bought. It created such a surplus of salmon that the U.S. Department of Agriculture bought almost 500 million servings of that salmon as surplus. And they have handed that salmon out now as salmon salad sandwiches in school lunch programs to feed American kids who can't afford to buy lunch, right? So, you know, when one old 60-year-old something guy and 11 younger people mm-hmm. can go out and you know, we can lift on our shoulders 4,050-pound bags and sprinkle our salt shaker worth of material over the ocean, and we can end up providing 500 million meals to needy American kids. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with that picture, right? You know, but that...
Russ's experiment, whether or not it was irresponsible, illegal, or just audacious, highlights the invisible opportunity costs that are so often not a part of how we make decisions. We can't anticipate the destruction that may be caused by global warming in the same way we can't quantify the risks posed by iron fertilization, but this does not free us from our responsibility to evaluate potential risk in relation to potential reward. If we do not, we are often fated to inaction and to hurling flack at those who would be so audacious as to act in the face of that risk.
Well, if you can bring the price of reducing the carbon dioxide problem on the planet, which is, you know, currently somewhere between $10 and $25 per ton mm-hmm. to reduce carbon dioxide from the air. If you can bring the cost down to a tiny fraction of that, our cost is probably a penny per ton. Mm-hmm. And so when you change the price of a commodity from $25 to 1 cent, there's the people who are selling the $25 technology will do anything and everything possible to prevent your technology from ever seeing the light of day, which has been the case. But
sure, it's the worst nightmare of an entrepreneur. I think you have more of the scientist in you than the entrepreneur, regardless of what people.
I'm a pretty high geek index, is basically right.
More than they give you credit for.
Yeah. Well, I do. I'm pretty good at business, but the geekiness of this idea is one of those miraculous ideas that's both simple and complicated, and you can explain it. You can describe it as simply as possible.
Sure, but you can also spend several hours discussing the issue, as we have leading up to this interview. Thank you for speaking with us today, Russ. We're going to have Russ George on next time for one more episode to further discuss the history of his work. To read and learn more about Russ George, visit theamericanelement.com.